Greetings once again, beloved podcast listeners. I'm here again with Lee and Dana. How are you guys?
I'm well.
I'm so good. Thank you for asking.
Oh, you're quite welcome. You're quite welcome.
I hope you're doing well, Stephen.
Oh, I am hanging in there. Yes. So we thought it would be an interesting topic to discuss today about children. And I think somebody actually mentioned this in the conference Dana and I were just at, but I was doing some other research and I found that the birth rate in the United States is 1.7, which is actually not even replacement rate. So basically, wow. the quick and dirty gist of that is that your culture, your society is on track to kind of disappear over a long enough timeline. So that brings up my first question for you guys, and that is, what does the Bible say, or what ought Christians to do when it comes to married couples, when it comes to having children? Would you say, Lee, I'll start with you. Would you say that zero children is on the menu? Would you say that, oh no, Christians should have 5, 10, 15 kids or two and no more? Or what are your what is your understanding of what the Bible would have to say to Christian prospective parents?
So I always advocate that Christians trust in the providence of God. So just as a blanket statement. But then as regards children, I think as many as the Lord gives you is the perfect number. That may be a bit of a Sunday school answer, but.
Well, I think I'm going to interrupt you right there, and I want to just say this, and I'll let you go on. We acknowledge that it is the Lord who opens the womb, right? Like,
yes.
Still, even today, right? Not just in the Old Testament, but even today, it is the Lord who opens the womb, and that might be at zero, right? There are people who are unable to have children, and we just have to praise God for them and pray with them through that affliction, I would say, because typically they are crushed that they can't have kids, at least for some time. So we acknowledge this, the Lord who opens the womb. Lee, take it away.
So I would say that it's the Lord who opens the womb, and a completely original thought that I would have said.
I'm getting edited out, aren't I?
No, not at all. That was beautiful. So you know, however many, whether it's zero, 10 or more, you know, however the Lord fills that quiver, will glorify God and will be a blessing. You know, as the sole childless member of this call, you know, that would be my counsel. We say all the time around here that children are always a gift from the Lord, and regardless of number, mm-hmm. zero, one, more, I think it's a blessing, and it's a wonderful thing to raise a family in the fear and admonition of the Lord. So I heartily endorse Christians having children.
Dana, yeah. What do you think?
I mean, that comes from Psalm 127, right? The whole concept of children mm-hmm. always being a gift from God or a blessing from God. So verse 3, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. So there's imagery there in the psalm, but essentially, for those who are trusting in God, you know, there is a it is a gift. It's a reward, actually, and so we have to, especially in our day and age when children, particularly like unborn children, are discarded just in concept as even being human. We want to say that, first of all, that life begins at conception. And we want to say that children are always a blessing from God. You know, God doesn't curse, God curses people, but he doesn't curse them. And now you're going to have a child, you know, like you are cursed with this child. And sometimes, like, so think of like Hosea. He was to name his children, not my people was one of them. That the name was a symbolic of the rejection of the people of Israel who are already had rejected God. By their actions, by their sin, they were rejecting God. And so the name was a symbol of that. But the child is never a curse on the people. The child is always a blessing to the parents, to the people within. Like we say it in our church because this past Sunday, I wasn't preaching. Actually, Pastor Ben was preaching. And at least from my perspective, I was sitting in the front row, kind of where I always sit, and it seemed noisy. The kids were really rambunctious. And maybe that's because I wasn't preaching, so I noticed it a little more. Because when I'm preaching, I don't really know. Sometimes I notice the really loud kids, but typically I don't really notice that. But I keep emphasizing that because sometimes we get in this in church, we can get, or in other places, right? We can get in this sort of mindset where, if those kids would just be quiet, you know, and we almost like, at least mentally, kind of push the kids to the side as like, just take them out. They shouldn't be in here, you know, that type of thing. But I want to continue to emphasize that children are a blessing from the Lord, and not just for mom and dad, for all of us in the church. So, I have a granddaughter, and Steve is a grandson, and those kids are blessings to us as grandparents, but Steve's grandson is a blessing to our family and to the whole church. You know, and you can see that in our church. You kind of have to be a part of it to see how much our church cares for the little ones, right? Mm-hmm. We try to regularly pray for pregnant moms and their babies. We have three that are due within a week of each other, coming up here in just about 2 or 3 weeks. It's a joy. It's a blessing. So I believe that, and I believe this is true, Psalm 127, that children are always a blessing from God, and we need to keep reminding each other of that.
Yeah, that's great. I think I'd
encourage Christian couples to not avoid having children either.
Yeah.
Say that again.
I would encourage Christian couples to not avoid having children either.
If they can,
like,
you mean?
To plan. Yeah, if they can.
Yeah.
Yeah. To plan on having kids, that's a good plan.
Well, and that, and that's the normal, like, so, and I already said this, there are instant, you know, the Lord opens and closes the womb. But the normal course of life is that married couples have children.
Yeah.
To plant, like, be fruitful and multiply is the command in Genesis, right? Mm-hmm. That's the command at the beginning. To say, nah, that's not for me. I mean, that's like to say that, like you're saying, to say that goes against the initial command of the Lord before even sin comes into the world, right?
Yeah.
I think it's fair to point out that although it may not have been the case in when the Book of Psalms was being written, in our day, our culture hates children.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And not just the unborn ones. They don't like the ones after they were born either. And you see that reflected culturally and even married couples, you know, delaying having kids in some cases, or choosing to just not have kids. Now, we need to add a caveat. I know we've mentioned this before, but what we can't do is look at a married couple. They've been married for 10 or 15 years and they have no kids and make some value judgment about their attitude toward children. Right. That would be potentially horrendously evil to do that. Yep. So as we zoom down closer and closer toward this married couple, we need to err on the side of extreme charity. We don't know what's going on. We're not necessarily privy to everything that's going on with them and their maybe desire to have children, maybe not, but we don't know. Now, I would make the argument that as we zoom out, and it could be a church, it could be a state, it could be a nation, and you look at people not having children, I'm more willing to kind of pass judgment on your attitude towards children in a way that you can't on one couple. But if you're talking about 100 million people who don't seem to be having a lot of kids, I do think it's fair to say this is reflective of your attitude toward children. Yeah. And I think it's so, in particular, when you look at Psalm 127 there, the illustration that the writer is using is arrows in the quiver of a warrior. So I've never been to war, but I worked with some people who went to war, and they would tell you, if you're going to go out on patrol, how much ammunition do you take? As much as there's no such thing as too much, right? And it's so
five,
much so
five
that
smooth stones.
Yeah. So someone who isn't going to go to war and that's not a part of their world might say, well, that seems excessive. Why would you ever need so much ammunition? Right. I think that is the picture being painted here by the writer. I don't think we're ripping it out of context to say if a child is really a blessing, then in some ways, a lot of them is the blessing multiplied. Right. Yeah.
More now, blessings are better than fewer blessings, I would suppose.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think we have a tendency, and I think it does bleed into even faithful churches where I don't know if we're totally sold on that. Are kids a lot of work? Yeah, they are. They're a tremendous amount of work. And they're also an incredible sanctification tool because some dying to self is going to happen. Right. And yeah. In a way that with no kids, there's all sorts of things that you can tolerate that are, let's just say, at the very least in the gray area, that you can't be doing that with some little person who's going to repeat everything they hear. Yeah. You got to ratchet it down pretty hard, or you're going to hear this repeated at a time when you might not want it to.
So,
yeah, wherever. Yeah. So you're going to have an interesting conversation with a Sunday school teacher or something. So I think that the principle that is clear is that children are a blessing. And if children are a blessing, you should want a lot of blessings.
Yeah.
So we're not going to give a specific number, of course, but, and the flip side of that is I don't think that we would condemn, well, I'll speak for myself. I would not condemn somebody if they were a married couple and he's about to go off to boot camp or something. Mm-hmm. And they think, well, maybe it would be good if I was home during the pregnancy. So we're going to push pause on this for 6 months and then we're going to pursue this blessing.
Yeah.
I'm not, whatever. That's fine. Right. I don't think that, says something about your priorities. That's out of whack. Right.
So you hit on something that, I just want to circle back to just a little bit. And you when you're talking about sanctification, you said, you mentioned raising children will help with your selfishness, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the core problem of our childlessness in our society.
I agree.
Is that people are selfish. So they're delaying, and it's like generational. Young adults are not growing up, so they're not moving out, they're not getting jobs. High school kids or even younger are not, they're not making hay in the summertime anymore. They're not mowing lawns,
yeah,
right? When they get older, they're not getting the job after school. In fact, I know college students that have never had a job. And I actually don't blame the student as much as the parents for not making them do that. So I'm just saying that like there's this delayed growing up. So that, you know, your first job isn't until you graduate college. Like that, you're not prepared for life if you're doing that. But that's kind of a different topic. I think there's a delay in marrying. There's a, you know, as a result, there's a delay in everything. So the average age of, you know, people getting married, I didn't look it up, but it's getting older and older. It's in the mid and upper 20s now. And I think it's at its root, it's selfishness. So there's probably overprotective parents that, you know, are afraid, you know, for their kids to do anything. And then when they get off and into school, they're sort of, they've been sheltered their whole life. And so now it's all about me, right? And so they're not getting married. They're not having kids until later. So that if they're not getting married until they're 27, 28, they're not having kids until they're into their 30s, even older. And I'm talking in society in general. And therefore, they're only having, well, 1 point, would you say 1.7, 1. Right?
1.7, yeah.
Yeah, so they're not even having like 2, 3, 4 kids. And so even now when you go out, if you go to a restaurant, if you have 4 kids and you go to a restaurant or it's not anywhere in public, you'll get like, you have 4 kids? Like that's a
crazy, you know what causes lot. That, don't you?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yes, I do, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's like,
you're almost seen as selfish by the culture.
Yeah. Right. It's all backwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what the world does. It flips everything around. It just distorts everything. But 4 kids is seen as a lot of kids in our society. 4 kids 50 years ago was nothing. Not even 50 years ago.
Back in the day, you need to have at least 6 kids in order to have one survive into adulthood.
Well, right. Yeah.
Not that long ago either.
Right. Right. I mean, it was that John Owen. I think it was John Owen.
He lost like 10 kids.
Right. Like in infancy or in young childhood.
Yeah. Infancy or toddlerhood.
I think only one made it to adulthood.
I think I might be so. Wrong. Something I could be like mixing his story up with somebody else too, but I know he lost a ton of kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I want to tack on to what you just said, Dana, when you're talking about in many cases, this may just come down to some selfishness, is you may have people, a young married couple with the attitude that, well, we can't afford children. And of course there are circumstances where someone is, for some reason, truly impoverished. Let's set that aside, because I don't think that is actually what's going on most of the time.
Right.
I think very often what's going on most of the time is I might, as a father, have to sacrifice some of the stuff I like in order to provide for my children. So the ironic thing is, if you look at birth rates, the countries where you have a birth rate of 4, 5, 6, 7 children are the poorest in the world.
Yeah.
You know, there's people who are not living on in a year what a lot of us make in a week, or in some cases maybe a couple days. They're still having a lot of children. So it's not that we actually can't afford it. It's that I might have to drive an older car, or I might have to sell my boat, or we may have to have a bigger, less luxurious apartment or house, but we need more space for more children or whatever. We could go down that list all day. But I think very often it's just, my life's going to be different. And, you know, I don't want to be, you know, have to give up anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's the wealthiest nations that are with the low falling birth rate. You're in Japan, yes. South Korea, nations in Europe, and the United States and Canada. Like, we're the wealthiest nations in the world have the lowest birth rates. It's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
The most materialistic.
Well, the family upending phenomenon of no fault divorce, I think, certainly plays a part too. Why would I, number one, why get married when you could be left for nothing in half of what you have taken, then two, why would I have a child with that person, especially so at least for a man, and have less likelihood of seeing that child hardly ever again? Those issues, which have actually been supported by civil government time and time and time again, I think that's played a huge part on the decline of the family in general, but especially birth rate in the U.S. especially. But I think that's that's a big issue too.
And connected to all of that, and maybe this is a little bit far afield, but connected to all of that, I know in talking to some of like the public school teachers that, you know, we have in our church, that it's becoming more and more common that the families that, you know, in our communities are all blended families. They don't know mom and dad. It's, you know, mom and boyfriend and his four kids, or, you know, kids from other women. Like it's this crazy blending, and it's every combination that anybody can ever think of is becoming more and more common. Right. When I was growing up, and I'm not that old, but when I was, I mean, I'm pretty old, but I'm not that old.
Come on.
But when I was growing up, like, very few people in my class were from divorced houses. Very few.
Yeah.
And now, like, I think it's very few that are from mom and dad, right? Mm-hmm. Still together and married with siblings, like the family unit that is normal,
intact,
right? Traditional family.
At the risk of getting into what probably should be a separate podcast, I think it's safe to say, I think we would all agree that the institution of marriage was under heavy assault long before any Supreme Court decisions about gay marriage or anything like that. Oh,
yeah.
It was
many,
many, many years before that.
Oh yeah.
There was a bombarding of traditional marriage and fracturing of some of the foundation of that. So, but that's that's probably another podcast we should do.
Well, I think it's okay, because we can't.
Can of worms opened.
Yeah.
It is open, and we can't blame, like, we want to look at politics as the reason, you know, we want to look at like the Supreme Court rulings or whatever as the reason for this is why we are because of those Democrats or something like that, right? But it goes so much further back than that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of the issues that directly we are facing now are traced back to, you know, the early 1900s into the 1800s. I mean, you can go back to the Enlightenment, but, you know, they're traced back over a long period of time. And, you know, directly.
Sin has a long history.
Exactly. And there's not, so, you know, we tend to think in history in terms of our own lifetime, or our recent memory. But while we can say that, like, we had a certain morality, say in the 1700s in America, or when we were founded, so 1700s, you know, colonies, and then founded as a nation, we had a certain morality that was influenced by the Reformation and all of that. But there's been an immorality all through history, right? Like in Bible times, Paul speaks to these things, for example, in the New Testament, because it was an issue, because prostitution was an issue in Corinth. You know, all kinds of immorality were issues that Paul had to write against. Don't be like the world. You know, instead be a husband of one wife. These roots go way back. Sin is a long history, I think you said, Lee.
Yep. Okay, so let's assume that some Christian married couples actually do have some kids, and now they are faced with another big question, and that is, how are those children going to be educated? And you can certainly find people who are, you know, putting their war paint on their face and ready to plant their flag on die on their particular, you know, their particular hill. But for the sake of our conversation, if we thought in terms of public school, private school, homeschool, would you say, and Dana, we'll throw this to you at first, Is there anything that you would say in the counsel of scripture that would say, you absolutely must do this one, you absolutely may not do this one? And if not, is there any counsel about this question for parents of school-age children?
There is counsel, yes. And I think, so the first thing I think of, you can go to the Shema, right? Deuteronomy 6. But let's bring it to the New Testament, which it says essentially the same thing in Ephesians 6, speaking specifically to fathers. Ephesians 6, 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, rather, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So I would say that fathers have a very specific task to bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And so it is ultimately, and I'm going to put mothers in that too, as a family, but dads as the head of the household. Too often dads are completely disengaged from any kind of education for their kids. And it's very clear in Ephesians 6 that dads are responsible. But let's just say parents are responsible for the instruction of their children. That I don't think that means that they have to teach them every single thing, right? If your son wants to go into becoming a firefighter, say, I don't think it's necessarily your responsibility. Okay, pick up your ladder. I'm going to show you how to.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, now there's some basics that maybe when they're kids, you're going to show them some of those things, right? But you know, we're going to rely on trained professionals at some point along the way, especially when we get into career type stuff. At some point, we're going to rely on some trained professionals for some of those things. But this says specifically the fear and instruction of the Lord, and I think we have to be careful whichever. If there's three categories of schooling, homeschool, Christian school, public school, if those are sort of the three broad categories, it's no matter which category you choose, it is the parents' responsibility to see that they are brought up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. It's not the Sunday school teachers. It's not the teacher at the Christian school or the public school. It's the parents' responsibility. My perspective would be this as far as the three. I actually believe that it depends on your community and where you live. And I think it depends on where your family is. So I want to be careful about this because now that I'm older and our kids are grown, like every other parent, right? I wish I had done some things differently. And if I lived here and knew what I knew now, then what I know now, then I probably would have homeschooled them all the way through. Our kids, our older son especially, actually has done all three. He started out in a Christian school. There was a good Christian school right around the corner from where we used to live when he was in kindergarten, and he went there for a couple of years, and it was a good school. I actually don't have much of a problem with it. It was right around the corner from our house. A lot of people from church went and there and taught there. And then actually right around the corner the other way from our house was a public school. And we also had several people from church involved in that in the elementary school. And it was a good school. It was good community. We moved into an area and we put them in the public school and it didn't go well. And I regret that. We took them out and homeschooled them after that. And I wish that we'd just homeschooled them when we moved there. But Lee, are you back? Nope.
He's not.
I'm pretty sure
he's having. Back.
He Maybe. Claims to be back.
My computer.
Yeah, he's having technical difficulties. So I would just say to piggyback on what you said, I would agree with everything you said, Dana. I would say that the idea, you know, we today talk in terms of education, like school. Am I going to go to this school, go to that school, or homeschool, or whatever? And the word education does not appear in the Bible. So the Bible would probably use the word discipleship, but it doesn't have any concept of school the way we have questions about what should I do with school in 2024 in America. And in the same way that it doesn't, the word internet doesn't appear in the Bible either. And the Bible doesn't have any concept of the internet. And so I think that we have to, you know, as Christians, we would not say absolutely no. And, you know, the internet is an abomination to the Lord.
Right.
We wouldn't say that.
Right.
And yet we would also say to parents, if you're just giving unfettered access to the internet to your five-year-old, you're doing it wrong. Right. Like that's a bad idea. Right. And, right. And that doesn't, even though you can get a lot of education over the internet, you don't get to just excuse yourself from that parental responsibility of discipleship. So it's still on you. The buck still stops with you. And we would say the same thing with whatever school choice you make. And so if you're going to allow your children, whether it's on the internet or at a school or a sports team or anywhere else, to engage in the world in some circumstances where there isn't the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of knowledge, then the burden's still on you to kind of address and correct some of those things. You can't just throw up your hands and just go, well, what are they teaching these kids these days? Well, not right. If it's your kids. Like you need to know that. And so you need to probably, what I would advise is think more in terms of discipleship. So in defense of those public school teachers, and we have a few that go to our church, it's not fair to say anything my kid picked up that I don't particularly like at school is just because those teachers are teaching that. There's a lot more discipling going on besides whatever your kid's teacher is going. There's discipling going on in the hallways and the locker rooms and the buses also. And as a parent, that's on you. You need to be engaging with that and know what's happening with that. And yeah. And so you can't absolve yourself of the responsibility for that. And that is a admonishment for whatever choice you make. Like you can run afoul whatever the choice is of just like, they're doing what? I didn't know. Oh, this got away from me. That's not going to fly from a biblical perspective. You need to know.
I want to back up just a little bit too, because in the public school sense, you know, historically speaking, you know, local. So in our nation, local public schools were really, the community got together. They hired a teacher, and there was a one room schoolhouse down the street, and everybody went. You know. Everybody in a local community went to that school, and all the parents were involved, and they had one teacher or just a couple of teachers, and it's grown into this huge bureaucracy. And the philosophy of public education, and now I'm talking big picture, not our public school teachers that go to our church, but the Department of Education and all of that, is very anti-Christian. And back from John Dewey and all of the, you know, sort of taking the Bible out of, because remember, like in the beginning of our nation and when our communities were being formed, you know, it was very Christian centered. And of course it would be different in different places, but they would say the Pledge of Allegiance, they would pray, they would use the Bible. And so it was families could trust, they knew the teacher, and the agenda wasn't some government agenda.
Yeah.
And now that's all different. And so one of the things that, you know, we have some public school families in our church and some teachers and those who work in the public school. And we, and Steve, you know this, but we pulled the teachers in and school employees in one day to meet with the elders and the deacons, just to say, like, we want to pray for you because you are missionaries, mm-hmm. the teachers, like those who are working, not students. I don't think kids should be sent into the public school as missionaries, but adults are going into a dark place or potentially dark place to teach things where it's very restricted what they can and can't say, especially as Christians. And as time goes, what it has seen in the last 20 years, 30 years, is a tightening of the restrictions on what can and can't be said. And so it's becoming more difficult for outspoken Christians to be involved. Where we live, it's easier because it's still, you know, we have teachers in a couple of different schools around here. It's still pretty small townish. And so they can get away with praying with a kid or, you know, something like that without it being an issue. But that's not the case everywhere. And so I would be in this day and age, if we had, you know, a kindergartner going off to school, I would be really hesitant to sending them to a public school. And I would be, as you were just saying, all that you were just saying of the parents need to be involved with every step of the way. I would really, really like keep your guard up theologically. If that's the case. I think it kind of goes back to the, we don't want to have kids because they're expensive argument. Sometimes people refrain from either sending their kids to a Christian school, or my preference would be homeschooling. They refrain from that because they think it's just going to be too expensive. We can't afford that. And I think that's a myth. I'm not saying it's free, but there are so many resources now. And we have several homeschooling families. Like you really could do it for very next to nothing. You know, with so many the resources that other families have that are further down the line that can hand stuff down to you, and other moms who've been doing it for years who are able to disciple, you know, you into how to do, you know, the things, the teaching. There's so many resources. And then there's so many co-ops too, which I think can be valuable depending on the family. Yeah. Where they get together and I don't, you know, especially when you get into older kids, I don't know anything about algebra. So, you know, this parent teaches that and this parent teaches that, but it's still done under the auspices of homeschool. And I think, so anyway, I think there's some resources now this year, like in current date that we have that weren't around 20, 30 years ago. And there's also a stigma that's been removed from it. You know, the argument against homeschooling when I was younger, when our kids were little, was, well, they won't be socialized, they won't know any, you know, that's just not true. And it's proving over and over and over again to be not true. Kids will, they'll either be antisocial or they'll be social.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. I think first of all, I think it's important. I want to acknowledge that those Christian teachers in the public school system are like they can really be a tremendous encouragement to Christian kids in the public school. So they can be a light in what could be at times a very dark place. And they are missionaries, and they are just such an encouragement to those kids. And I also think it's fair to acknowledge that there is the potential for shipwreck on any of those choices. So we could send, you could make the same mistakes with it. For example, a private Christian school, and I'm just, they're going to take care of it. I'm sure it's good. It's a Christian school. Well, half of what we talk about in this podcast are people who are standing under the banner of Christianity who are kind of like all messed up. Like they're not like they got major doctrinal problems. So again, there's like the buck stops with, in particular, dad, right? And there's certainly, you could certainly have a scenario even with homeschooling where it's like, oh, well, the co-op's taking care of this. And it might be harder to check out, maybe in some ways, but it's just a natural human tendency to just like, I just want to like, what can I do so I don't have to pay attention to this? And the answer, I would argue biblically, is that ain't how it worked. You ain't getting out of this. You're a parent, and you need to be engaged, and it is going to require a lot of your attention and time and energy, no matter what. And absent that, then we get into a real problem. We get into a real problem that way. So
yeah, and one of the challenges with Christian schools that I've run across, and I've had a couple of association with a couple of different Christian schools. One of the challenges is they're usually fairly ecumenical, so they're usually fairly broad
in
who they're bringing in. And there's a couple of different philosophies. There's some Christian schools that are evangelistic in nature, and so they allow unbelieving kids or families in. Most of the ones that I've had contact with are Christians, and the families, usually there's a requirement that they go to a church. And I think that's great. I think they can give you the basics of the gospel. But usually when it comes to any kind of doctrinal distinctives, those ecumenical schools are usually on a pretty low level.
Yeah, so they're not gonna going to get that.
Yeah, they're not going deep into any kind of doctrine. So if you think that they're going to, even if they have a Bible class, you think that they're going to teach your kids the deep truths of God that the kids can handle. They can handle it. They're not going to. I mean, typically, they're going to keep everything pretty low. And so that, I think it's important to remember, you know, going right along with what you were saying, that it is our responsibility to teach those things, and discernment and all of that. So I think Christian schools have their place. I think they're fine. We have kids, families in Christian schools here. We have kids that are involved in sports at Christian schools. I think there's some really good things connected to all of that. But we just got to know as you're going into it that what you're getting into, and that's probably good on that.
Yeah. Apparently, Lee has no thoughts on the subject. He's having he's having some technical difficulties. So. So it might be there may only be he's back.
When it comes to talking about schools, Lee is out.
He checked out.
I can see him.
You, we still can't hear you.
Give it one last try.
Yeah.
So he throws his hands up.
Well, I'll tell you what, Lee, if we're gonna ascend the ladder, we might not be able to hear you. You wanna hold the book up so we can see it?
I bet we can't see it either.
Oh, we might not be able to see it. Can he hear us? One second.
1 second. First word. Sounds like
the movie. This is going to go to the Podcasting Hall of Fame.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my. Okay.
Dude,
might this be a series of books?
Two thumbs up. Eye of Sauron.
Yeah.
Is that a ring?
I think it's one ring circle? To rule them all. Yes.
Lee is recommending fiction, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Yes. The link will be in the show notes. So
The Lord of the Rings.
The Lord of the Rings trilogy or one gigantic book, depending on how you buy it. Yes. Yes, which is very good. I would agree with them. Thumbs up there. Not short, but really good. So fun one to read to your kids if you have kids at home that are old enough to get a lot out of it. That would be a good one to do. So we're in hearty agreement. What you got, Dana?
I'm going with a biography. The Life of Martin Lloyd-Jones by Ian Murray. Martin Lloyd-Jones, the doctor. One of my favorite stories is, so he was a preacher in London during World War II, so through the middle of the 1900s. And during the war, as the Germans were bombing, he's preaching, and bombs are striking so close that people are ducking down in the pews and dust is falling. And he just keeps preaching. So he is just a stalwart. So Martin Lloyd-Jones, this is The Life of Martin Lloyd-Jones by Ian Murray. This is excellent.
Nice.
Highly recommend biographies.
All right. So I'm deviating from our usual theological nerddom shelf, and I'm doing something a little different here. This is Viktor E. Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Hmm. It's one of those books that I would say you read this, and it hopefully, Lord willing, is going to spur an interesting conversation. I don't think Mr. Frankl and I would agree, maybe, what gives man meaning. I'll leave it at that. But it's still an interesting story. He was a prisoner in Nazi concentration camps and had a very difficult experience. And so from that, he is trying to answer the question, how do human beings find meaning? Is it pleasure? Is it power? Is it something deeper? And we would all say it is for sure something deeper. And I just think it would spur an interesting conversation if you read that book with somebody and we could talk about what we as Christians.
Sorry that my technical difficulties ruined the end of the episode, but definitely encourage those three books. Here's a blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Amen.